Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you all to our Independent Policy Forum luncheon today. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors programs featuring outstanding experts to address major economic and social issues, especially as they may relate to important new books, and today is no exception. For those of you who are new to the Institute, you'll find background information at your seat. The Independent Institute is a nonprofit, non-politicized, scholarly research and educational foundation located actually in Oakland. The Institute regularly sponsors in-depth studies of major public policy issues. We produce about 6 to 10 books per year. The approach that we use is somewhat different in the hallmark of public policy. The approach that we take is best described as non-politicized or perhaps Jeffersonian in some respects. The approach we take is to try and seek truth regarding the impact of government policies and not necessarily to tell people just what they might want to hear. In so doing, we will not take the public pronouncements of government officials at face value necessarily, nor the conventional wisdom of the day. Hence, we invite your involvement in this program and many others, but be prepared for new and perhaps challenging perspectives. Neither seeking nor accepting government funding, the Institute draws its support from a diverse range of foundations, businesses, and individuals, and we invite everyone here to become a tax-deductible member. Also in your packet, you'll find information on the benefits of becoming a member, as well as information about a recent book of ours that's been getting quite a bit of attention called Out of Work. For those of you also not familiar with the catalog, review catalog we produce called Liberty Tree, there are copies at the front exhibit. Liberty Tree carries about 800 titles that deal with many issues of American political culture and other topics. Our program today could really not be more timely. The issue that we're addressing has been in the news quite a bit lately. And I think that many, many people are asking more and more whether Hollywood, the so-called American Dream Factory, is becoming Hollywood, the American Nightmare Factory. One of the questions that I think is most interesting about our speaker today is that he was perhaps one of the first people to ask whether Hollywood, in many respects, is somewhat self-destructive, as it seems to ridicule not only business and mainstream values, but many of the signs that markets in the entertainment field seem to be raising. And more people, of course, are asking why there is such a proliferation of cruelty and brutality in popular music, films, and television. In the past, the private and localized institutions of home, church, synagogue, school, neighborhood, and business provided the framework for many of the values that we cherish in society. But in our highly politicized age, government has come to be the new parent to set the standards and values of so much of our lives, from education to health to business to safety, and most recently, evenly, the so-called politically correct elements of human relationships. This civic religion of government as parent has dominated our culture for decades, and little by little, private institutions have been undermined or eliminated as government has expanded. But a society that increasingly turns to the moral leadership, for moral leadership to the professional duplicity of the politician and the catch-22 mindlessness and arrogance of the bureaucrat may indeed be asking for trouble. Had recent events such as the Polyclas kidnapping, the Rodney King and Reginald Denny beatings, the Los Angeles riots, the tragedy of Waco, could many of these events involving a government of, say, during Jefferson's time and perhaps throughout most of American history, I dare say most of society would not tolerate it. But in our age, such events have become all too commonplace, with sensitivity to the horror of violence and human degradation trivialized and, in fact, exalted in much of popular culture and entertainment. However, within recent years, many people have once again begun to seek responsibility for their own lives. Despite the rumblings in Washington for ever more power, there is indeed a growing grassroots movement for empowerment and decentralization in America to take charge of many areas of our own lives in, say, education and crime prevention and so on. And I would suggest that in the area of communications and entertainment, our speaker today has been one of the key leaders. In survey after survey, large majorities are registering a distaste today for the entertainment industry's torrent of nihilistic and violent work. Voting with their money, much of the public has increasingly been turning such projects into financial ruin, while those films, TV, and other programs that embody values of individual achievement and humaneness are increasingly proving to be the real economic success stories. In his book, Hollywood versus America, our speaker today presents a comprehensive and devastating critique of why movies, popular music, and television have become dominated by such brutality and perhaps even a hatred for civility. He will discuss how an industry can ignore messages of markets and the public at large. Many of us believe that, unlike any single book, Hollywood versus America has been transforming the debate over popular culture, calling a bluff on, too often, the bulk of a cynical media. In response to this debate this past weekend, as many of you know, President Clinton spoke out against violence in popular entertainment at a fundraising event hosted in Southern California by a number of film celebrities and executives. However, as I've suggested, Americans have too long turned to government for directions, only to fall prey to even greater travesties. In rejecting censorship as a dangerous offshoot of an assault on many values, our speaker will demonstrate instead how public pressures can produce powerful results in bringing Hollywood into a business and cultural arena where beauty is not ridiculed, people are not brutalized, and cruelty is not exalted. Michael Medved is film critic for the New York Post and co-host of Sneak Previews, the weekly PBS movie review program that is broadcast over 200 stations in the U.S. He's an honors graduate of Yale University, former screenwriter. He's the author of actually 7 books, including The Shadow Presidents, What Really Happened to the Class of 65, and Hospital. He is the co-founder of the Pacific Jewish Center, and in 1993, he was awarded an honorary doctorate by the Hebrew Theological College, Jewish University of America. I'm very pleased today to introduce him to speak on Hollywood's 3 big lies about media and society, after which he'd be happy to answer questions and also to autograph copies of his book if you so choose to get one. So, introduce Michael.
Thank you, David, and thank you to all of you for braving the elements here and joining us today. And it's always very nice to sit back after lunch and hear these kind words about my work, particularly because when this book initially came out, you should know, if you're not aware, that not all responses were quite as generous. This book provoked some of the most enthusiastic reviews that I have ever encountered, and I'll give you just a few examples. Michael Winner, who's a film director, who directed Death Wish, and he directed Death Wish 2, and he also directed Death Wish 3, and he has a new film coming out in February, Death Wish 4. That's for real. Michael Winner reviewed my book and called it the worst read of the decade, which I was enormously flattered by. It's only 1993. Seemed a bit premature. But a Variety had a front page editorial attacking me and my book with a really very unflattering caricature, I must say, of me on it. And the headline for that editorial was, "The Hills Are Alive with the Sound of Medved." And it concluded the editorial by saying that a good case can now be made that Medved should be banned from all future screenings, which, concerning the issues of censorship that David invoked before, I think it's fascinating that here's this industry that is absolutely committed to free expression, except if you use that right of free expression to criticize them. And one of my favorite encounters was I was on the BBC. They did an hour-long special called Medved's Hollywood. And they threw in a bunch of studio heads and directors. And the director, Paul Verhoeven, was there. And he's the author of such worthy contributions to our civilization as RoboCop and Total Recall and Basic Instinct, which I had previously reviewed under the title Basically It Stinks. And Mr. Verhoeven was kind enough to call me a Nazi. And I took particular umbrage at that, since my mother had escaped from Germany in 1935 with her family when she was 9 years old. And so it went. And, you know, I must tell you that I knew this book was going to be controversial. You don't write a book and call it Hollywood versus America and then expect to get the Man of the Year award from the Motion Picture Association. It's, you know, that's not going to happen. But the kind of violent, angry, furious response that was engendered here rather surprised me. It surprised me because, just as David Thoreau told you, the general acknowledgement that our popular culture is in sad shape is well nigh universal. You don't even find people within the entertainment industry who will maintain with a straight face that movies today are better than ever. There is an absolute agreement among Americans of every political persuasion that we have some problems with the entertainment industry and its impact. Have you ever met anybody who said, you know, I've got a terrible problem at home. I wish I could get my kids to watch more TV. You know, I'm afraid they're not watching enough of this benign force in their lives. That this sensibility doesn't exist in this country. People are dissatisfied. So it wasn't the fact that I have some critical things to say about the aesthetic standards of the industry that provoked the kind of response that my book generated. I believe what upset people so much was that what I set out to do was to undermine the three basic exculpatory lies that the industry always uses to try to escape any responsibility for what it's doing to society. And what I want to do with you very briefly is talk about those three lies and then open it up to your questions. Because I think that by focusing on some of the lines that are hammered home again and again and again, we can begin to see what the real issues are. And the three lies are, first of all, we don't influence anybody, we just entertain people. Lie number two is, we don't shape society, we just reflect social reality. And lie number three is, we're just good businessmen who give the public what it wants, so don't blame us, blame yourselves. How many of you here have heard one or more of these lines at various times? Okay, very common. The first lie, we don't influence anybody, we just entertain people. You know, I had a fascinating illustration of this hypocritical thinking, this absurd double standard, when I was invited a few months ago, believe it or not, to participate in a panel along with three presidents of major film studios. And one of these gentlemen got up after I spoke and he said, you know, the trouble with Michael Medved is he only looks at the damage we do. He never acknowledges the good that we do for the society. He said, for instance, you won't hear Michael Medved say that our movie, Lethal Weapon 3, saved thousands of American lives. Now, he then went on, and, you know, I'm sitting here feeling incredibly obtuse. I had seen the movie. I had reviewed it. You know, its life-giving messages were not immediately discernible to me. So when it came time for me to have a rebuttal statement, I began by saying, you know, I think I may have missed something in what you just said. Could you explain to me how it is that Lethal Weapon 3 saved all these lives? So it's very simple. I think everybody else here saw it, even if you didn't and understood, is there's a key scene in the movie where right before Danny Glover and Mel Gibson go off on their high-speed chase, we do an intense close-up, and you see for 4 seconds them fastening their seatbelts. Now, you know, think about the logic here. The logic is that 4 seconds of seatbelt fastening will be imitated by millions of people. But the rest of the movie's running time, the other 99.9% of the movie's running time, which is eye gougings and eviscerations and knife wounds and gunshot wounds and explosions and car chases, that nobody will imitate. I mean, are we supposed to believe that the audience is sleeping and then they wake up for the seatbelt scene? You know, the same logic applies to advertising on TV. I was very struck. In 1982, the Surgeon General of the United States released a major report, this is 11 years ago, about the risks and the dangers of televised violence. And the report was accompanied by 5 outstanding volumes of research, totaling about 4,000 pages, proving beyond any question that prolonged exposure to televised images of violence creates more violent, hostile, and aggressive attitudes and behaviors in a significant portion of the people who are so exposed. You know how ABC Network officially responded to this study? Surgeon General of the United States. Vice President of ABC for Public Affairs declared, and I quote him in my book, "There is no conclusive evidence whatsoever that televised imagery impacts real-world behavior in any way." You know what the response should be to that? Oh, yeah, if that's the case, then begin refunding billions of dollars in advertising revenue. Because if televised imagery doesn't impact real-world behavior, then what right do you have to charge hard-working businessmen hundreds of thousands of dollars for 30 seconds of ad time to sell everything from canned goods to candidates? How absurd! Are we supposed to believe the American people out there are watching their TV sets, but they're sort of dozing off, but then all of a sudden the commercial comes on and bing, they pay attention? The 30 seconds will influence them, but 30 minutes won't? How ridiculous this is! It's so ridiculous that my former law school classmate, who currently serves as President of the United States, even commented on precisely this point this weekend to a lot of people who had given him a great deal of money to get him elected. The fact is that the influence is inescapable. Now, does that mean that everybody's influenced? No, it does not. And it's very important to understand this. The advertising model is very useful for dealing with another argument that you hear from time to time. Recently, I was on Crossfire, the Crossfire TV show, with my old buddy Jack Valenti, the head of the Motion Picture Association of America. By the way, I am the only person in history who has been officially condemned by 3 formal statements from the Motion Picture Association. I mean, I take that as a great honor. In any event, so we were debating, and Valenti makes this line, and he says, "You know, the fact is that my wife and I have successfully raised 3 fine children, upstanding children, 2 girls and 1 boy, and they watched a great deal of violent televised material when they were younger. We couldn't get them away from those TV screens. They watched murders. They watched gunfights. They watched a great deal of material that some might consider harmful. And they've grown up to be fine citizens, mothers and fathers, people who are a credit to their parents and to their country." Well, you know, great. What wonderful logic. It is so simple, but it's so difficult to try to make people understand that the fact that televised imagery doesn't impact everybody doesn't mean that it doesn't impact anybody. Let me try a little game here. And in this group, it might be a little bit risky, but I'm going to do it anyway. How many people here have ever tuned in to television and seen an ad for the Lexus automobile? Okay, pretty much all of you. How many people here drive a Lexus? No? Oh, one person. Okay, well, I think we've proven with this group, haven't we, that the Japanese are not as smart as we thought they were. The Toyota Motors, which owns Lexus, is wasting all this money on these TV ads, right? Look at all the people who saw the ad. And only one of you bought the car. What a waste of money. That's just like Jack Valenti's logic. They don't have to get everybody to buy the car to have an impact on that corporation's bottom line. Anybody here who's ever bought advertising for your company or your product knows you're crazy if you try to sell to everybody. You have a small target group, and you reach that target group, the advertising can be profoundly effective. The same thing is true of images of violence and self-destructive sexual behavior and other kinds of antisocial behavior in TV and in the movies. You don't have to influence everybody or even a majority of people in order to have a profound impact on society. If 1% of the people who see that material are influenced to perpetrate violent behavior through what they see, and statistics indicate it's significantly more than 1%, could be as much as 5%, what an impact that has on society. What an impact it has on the overall crime rate. What an impact it has on the climate of violence, and there's something else. That ad for Lexus may not have sold you the car, but it did do something, even for those of you who haven't bought the car. You know what it did? It changed your image of that product. It makes Lexus look desirable, chic, hip, sexy, a status symbol, something to reach for. By the same token, repeated exposures to images of sexuality and violence in the mass media, even for those who don't imitate it directly, changes your attitude toward that behavior. It makes it look normal. In that way, the fundamental power of television and motion pictures and popular music is the power to redefine what constitutes normal behavior in this society. It is through the popular culture that millions upon millions of Americans not only learn different standards of what is accepted, but learn different standards about what is expected. And that brings us to the second lie. And it's a more difficult one to address, and probably become even more common. Today, only rarely now will you hear people saying, well, we have no influence at all. There's a great guilt feeling sort of beginning in Hollywood, appropriately. But so they go back to the second standard. They say, well, yes, we do work that may be damaging, but don't blame us. We just reflect what's there in society. If the world you see up there on screen is ugly and dangerous, it's because the real world is ugly and dangerous. We're just holding a mirror up to nature, as Hamlet told the player Prince to do in Act 3. And reflecting back to you what exists in real life. This has a certain credibility to it, but not after you spend more than 5 minutes investigating the subject. I'll give you the most clear and obvious demonstration. It's a demonstration from a rabid, radical, fire-breathing, right-wing extremist organization called the Screen Actors Guild. Not, as they say in Wayne's World. Wayne's World 2 is coming out this Friday, so I'm very Wayne's World conscious. No, the Screen Actors Guild is not a right-wing organization, but one of the things that they did was they monitored over the last 5 years who got jobs among actors. And you know what's fascinating? In motion pictures, over the last 5 years, 72% of all speaking parts went to men. In television series, 64% of all speaking parts went to men. When it comes to lead roles, those roles that are listed usually above the title, over 75% of the parts went to men in both TV and movies. Is that reality? Thank God it's not! Can you imagine if we lived in a world that was 75% male? That world would be brutal and nasty and coarse and violent, just like the world up there on screen. Because the whole addiction to using men at the exclusion of women is precisely related to the addiction to violence. And the need to overstate the levels of violence horribly and irresponsibly. Another little survey here. How many people here have ever in real life witnessed a murder? No one. Thank God. How many people here have ever seen a murder on TV? How many people here have seen a murder dramatized or reported on, oh, say, in the last day? We all have. We see it constantly. This notion that we just report on reality is absurd. It is destructive. It is poisonous. It's not true. The most violent ghetto in American life isn't South Central Los Angeles. It's primetime television, where violence is overstated grotesquely. And by the way, this is particularly true with portrayals of African Americans. You know, I was fascinated recently, just a couple of months ago, there was a Gallup poll where it was an unusually large Gallup poll, 3,000 respondents, and they asked people to self-describe themselves in terms of their religiosity. 32% of all Americans describe themselves as born-again Christians. 52% of African Americans. 52%! You see that a lot on TV? You see that a lot in the movies? All you see in portrayals of African Americans is thugs and drugs. And it doesn't make it any better that it may be a black director who's doing it. It's not reality. But there it is. It becomes reality when it's there on screen. And you know, it's also the sources of violence. Not just the fact that violence is so grossly overstated. Do you know what the most murderous, dangerous, irresponsible, bloody-handed group in society is, according to network TV? There's one occupational group responsible for 40% of all murders on television. That's a higher percentage than members of the mafia or any other group. You know what occupational group that is? Businessmen! So after lunch, when you go back to the office, you better pick up a bulletproof vest, because you have no telling who's keeping a gun in his drawer, who's going to shoot you. Now, this is absurd. You know, I actually went to some trouble to go to the FBI, the Bureau of Crime Statistics. The actual statistics, about 0.5% of all murders are committed by businessmen, not 40%. And almost all of those are domestic tragedies. This is absurd. It's not reality. Hollywood doesn't reflect reality. And there's something else related very much to what we were talking about the African-American community. You know, there's a certain kind of activity in which Americans engage with great frequency, which never occurs on television or at the movies. It's an activity in which people engage 5 times the number of people engaged in that activity every weekend as those who go to the movies. You know what I'm talking about? Church and synagogue, worship services. According to CNN, Newsweek, the Lewis Harris poll, the Gallup poll, every major survey, between 40 and 45% of all Americans go to church or synagogue every week. We see that a lot on TV? Hardly. Religiosity has to be the least reflected aspect of American life. That same Gallup poll I talked about before, 64% of Americans say that they regularly bless their food before they eat it. You know, the only kind of grace I can think of that takes place on TV, aside from the Waltons reunion show, which, by the way, got the biggest ratings of any TV movie of the last 4 years, when it just played on November 22nd. But aside from the Waltons reunion show, there's a segment on The Simpsons where Bart says, "Dear God, we paid for all this stuff ourselves, so thanks for nothing." Not reality. And so the question here would be, well, it's true, maybe it's true Hollywood distorts things, but Hollywood's always distorted things. I mean, remember at the height of the Great Depression, when a third of a country was out of work, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers were gliding together over polished marble. Hollywood's always distorted reality. And who says that reproducing reality makes good entertainment? Well, they're right. But the distortions in the past used to be distortions to make the world more beautiful, more dramatic, more elegant, more heroic. Today, and this is why Hollywood's in trouble financially, today, it's the other direction. If reality is distorted, it's to make things look worse than they are, to make them look more violent, less organized, more broken down, more threatening, more menacing, more ugly, and to concentrate on characters who are lowlives. I mean, I can't tell you, I see 5 and 6 movies a week. You come home from a lot of these things feeling like you need a shower. You know, what is the point of this? Focusing on characters who are less decent, less intelligent, less noble than our own friends and neighbors. So what impact does it have? What difference does it make? Let me tell you something. One of the most fascinating books I've ever read, and I highly recommend it to you. If it's not covered by the Independent Institute, it should be on your book list, is a book called Thinking About Crime by the outstanding sociologist James Q. Wilson. He has another wonderful book out called The Moral Sense. He's a great writer. In Thinking About Crime, Wilson makes an observation about a statistical quirk that had been observed in every continent of the world. And that is a quirk called the broken windows effect. If there is a factory or an apartment or a home with broken windows that go unrepaired, then that block on which that occurs will become a center for crime. In other words, they can look at broken windows or graffiti, and wherever you go in the world, that particular street that has those markings will have a higher crime rate than a street one block away where the windows have been repaired. So Wilson asks a very profound question. Why? What difference should it make? Why should broken windows that go unrepaired cause crime? And the answer he gives is very profound and very, very important to remember. Those broken windows are an eloquent witness. They send a message. You know what the message is? The message is that here chaos reigns. Authority is broken down. This is a dangerous place. Good people, stay away. Law-abiding people, keep out. Criminal elements, this is your place. Television and movies have become gigantic broken windows to this entire society. That's why it matters that they reflect reality so poorly. Aside from the fact that this pessimistic, nihilistic, unjustifiably dark view of our society doesn't work at the box office. And that brings me to my third point. The third point is a response to their line, well, you know, you can't blame us. We're just capitalists. We're just in it for the money, and we give the public what it wants. So once again, don't blame us. Blame yourselves. If you stop buying tickets, we'd stop making these movies. Let me tell you about a movie I saw last night. It's one of the big Oscar contenders for this year. It's approximately a $40 million picture. It's called Philadelphia. Has anyone else here seen it by any chance? It's coming out. It's released on Christmas Day. It's a wonderful holiday delight in which, in the course of 2 hours, you get to see Tom Hanks die of AIDS. The only thing that's convincing in the film is the way they show the changing color of his skin and the pallor and the deathliness and the lesions. There's really great makeup effects that they use for these lesions. But here's a film. The plot of the film basically is Tom Hanks is a hotshot lawyer in Philadelphia who is keeping a secret, the fact that he has AIDS, and then he starts having to take time off to go to the hospital to get blood transfusions, and the evil people who run his firm terminate him because they feel he can't do his work because he's spending too much time in the hospital. So Tom Hanks sues with the help of Denzel Washington, and I don't want to tell you how it comes out, but you can imagine. And, you know, there's one question about this movie. Do they really believe they're going to make money on it? No. Could any sane person say, well, you know how people go to the movies? Going to the movies is a date experience. Hey, come on, honey, let's go see that movie about AIDS. There's not a chance in the world they're going to have to subpoena people to go see this movie. It also happens to be not very good. But it's $40 million of TriStar's money. It's a big movie. And there's another movie I saw last week, and this one happens to be a great movie, and I'm glad they made it. But it's another very big commercial long shot. It's called Schindler's List. It's Steven Spielberg's movie. It's a 3.5-hour black and white film about the Holocaust. It's brilliant. It probably will win the Oscar this year for Best Picture. It is going to be an incredibly tough sell. If you think that Universal Studios authorized Schindler's List in order to clean up at the box office because they're greedy capitalists, I mean, what's the marketing tie-in for Schindler's List? All of other Spielberg's other movies have marketing tie-ins. It's not money. Steven Spielberg earlier this year made more money than God himself. He had the top-grossing commercial film in history with Jurassic Park. So why Schindler's List? Why a 3.5-hour black-and-white movie about the Holocaust? Because the profound motivator in this industry is a desire for respect. A desire to win the respect of your peers. That's why there are all these inexplicable decisions from a commercial viewpoint. Movie after movie, even TV show after TV show that comes out where there's no chance it'll play out commercially. You think they made money on When the Band Plays On? Other dramatization of the AIDS? No, but they won awards from the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. And HBO got lots of credit and lots of pats on the back for what they were doing. What has happened in Hollywood has been the lunatics have taken over the asylum. Sometimes it has wonderful impact for terrific movies like Schindler's List. Sometimes it has insane impact. But the one thing you can see in film after film after film is this is not, as people believe, a simple capitalist candy machine where they only give you what the public pays for. All the time they make movies that they think are good for you, or they will put elements in other movies that the public clearly doesn't want. Anybody here see the movie Beethoven? About a big slobbery St. Bernard, a 185-pound drooling hunk. I saw it with my kids, and it was a very likable movie, made $80 million. Now they have Beethoven Second, also coming out a week from Friday. Now, Beethoven Second has a scene in it about date rape. It's a movie for four-year-olds. They have a song on the soundtrack in this movie for four-year-olds that says, I want you to come spend the night with me tonight because I've got a rocket full of kryptonite. What are they thinking of? Is this a commercial decision? No way. And the best illustration of how the movie industry is not commercially motivated is it with violence. Because, yes, there's an audience for violence, largely comprised of drooling, subliterate, hormone-addled adolescent boys, and you know who you are. But what's the audience for language? Where is the commercial demand for all the F words and the S words in movies? In PG movies, last year, 46% of movies rated PG had either the F word or the S word. Who would miss this language in such a movie if it weren't there? It's insane. It's ludicrous. You know, last year on Christmas Day, and to me, one of the highlights of insanity in the whole history of Hollywood, 20th Century Fox released a warm, cuddly, feel-good Christmas treasure called Hoffa about everybody's favorite dead Teamster leader. A $50 million stinkeroo starring Jack Nicholson and Danny DeVito. I mean, it's extraordinary. Do you know how many F-words there were in that movie? Now, I don't count these, you know. I subscribe to a service. It's comprised, I think, of little gnomes who go out with little counters and keep their thumbs busy. But Hoffa was a 112-minute movie with 268 F-words. You think there's an audience that demanded that? I mean, think how easy that makes that for the screenwriter. He just hits the same key of the word processor again and again and again. You know, what amazed me is they recently announced they were doing an airline version of Hoffa. I thought it would be about 10 minutes long. You know how? But you know, look, this movie came out, $50 million. Again, they had to subpoena people to see it. It absolutely died at the box office. I have never in my life heard of anyone who came out of a theater saying, you know, Mabel, I really like that picture, but the language in it was just too clean for me. You know, who thinks like that? You know what it is? When you're 12 years old, maybe 13, and you're a boy, a hormone-addled boy, You very often will say, well, you know, I'm going to use that language and my parents will be upset. And you do that kind of thing. You talk dirty and you get bawled out. Most of us outgrow it. Not the people who make movies. They're still there wanting so desperately to pose as rebellious, cutting-edge artists. They don't want to be seen as members of the establishment. They don't want to be seen as entrepreneurs or entertainers. They want to be seen as artists to hook up with the good old days when they wore black turtlenecks and drank strong coffee and talked together about existentialism. I mean, this is nonsense. To me, one of the most important things in my entire book is the statistical analysis that proves, and by the way, has now been confirmed by four other studies since my book came out, that proves that movies aimed at family audiences, rated PG and G, have an average box office performance 2 to 3 times higher than R-rated movies. It's been like that for over 10 years. They do better. The top grossing movie of any film released in 1992, anybody know? Aladdin, one of only 14 movies that entire year rated G, earned more than $50 million more than anything else released that year. This notion that you've been told that you have to put in the language and the sex and the violence, otherwise it doesn't sell, is garbage. It's a giant lie. In 1992, the average PG and G-rated film, taken together, earned 3 times as much on average at the box office as a film rated R, and yet 61% of all titles were rated R, and that percentage of R-raters had gone up and up and up. From 46% in 1983 up to 61% in 1992. Okay, now to conclude all of this, what do you do about it? We've talked about three big lies. How do you answer lies? The only answer lies in one way, and that's by telling the truth to your family, to your friends, to your society, and most of all, telling the truth to yourselves. And for each of these lies, that's crucial. On the first lie, the idea that we don't influence people, we just entertain them. Recognize that that's a lie and become more discerning consumers. Not only in restricting what children watch, though that's important, but restricting what you yourself watch. Because you know what? It always strikes me, you have parents all the time who'll talk to their kids about watching less. But anyone here who's a parent knows that the only way that you really influence children is by changing your behavior. Your own behavior, not by talking at them. And you know, it strikes me as extraordinary. Right now, there's so many parents, particularly in California, who are very concerned about their kids eating too much cholesterol or unrefined sugar or polyunsaturated fats, but they seem not to care what their kids place in their minds and their imaginations and their very souls. Recognize that these images do influence, that messages matter, and become more discerning consumers. And ideally consume less. For the second lie, the lie that we just reflect reality, too many Americans fall into that. They watch TV news. They get their entire impression of what's going on in the world from that little box in their household. You know, sometimes I think, imagine if a Martian had his impression of America based only on reflecting a satellite dish that received messages and signals from Earth, American TV. You know what he'd conclude? He'd conclude from watching the morning shows, you know, Geraldo and Oprah and Phil Donahue and Montel Williams and Jane Whitney and all of, you know what he'd conclude? That this was a country that was had more transvestites in it than churchgoers. Keep in mind at all times that the world you see in the media isn't reality. The world is better than that. There's more decency. There's more hope. There's more goodness among every racial and ethnic group in every corner of the society. The hugest underreported instance in the media is goodness. Simple wholesomeness and decency. And on the third point, and this is particularly challenging, the idea, their lie that, well, we just give the public what it wants. The question that one could well ask is, since they don't give the public what it wants, what hope do we have? It means that sponsor boycotts, that attempts to influence them, if they're willing to lose money on this material, then how do you influence them? And there are two things. First of all, it does make a difference to point out that it's stupid business. People do get embarrassed about losing tons of money. Sometimes they'll say, well, that shows how noble I was and how selfless. But I do think that frankly, all the discussion of ratings and the different box office performance of different rated movies that was launched by my book has had an impact, a real impact. I'm very proud of it. 1993 isn't over yet, but I have the statistics up through December 1st. In 1992, 12% of all movies were rated PG or G. In 1993, it's over 30%. In 1992, 61% were rated R. In 1993, up through December 1st, it was less than 40%. There is a readjustment going on. It's healthy. It's overdue. And that's one of the reasons, by the way, that this year has been somewhat better for the box office. What we need to do is to show people that making a shocking, cutting-edge, blood-soaked project not only is not going to make money, but it's not worth praise. It's one of the reasons I'm very hopeful that this year, after 2 years where the Academy Award-honored pictures were Silence of the Lambs and Unforgiven I thought was a pretty good picture, by the way, but it was also a very bloody picture, that maybe we'll have some different kinds of Oscar contenders this year. Because this question of respect and how respect is handed out in Hollywood is very important, and I believe that's changing and has to change as well. What does all of it mean? It doesn't mean that we're suddenly going to get inspiration from our TV screens or from our movies, that it will suddenly become a huge force for goodness, but I think it means that we can reduce the damage that the popular culture does. What I'm eager for is not something where we turn out all Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm or even all Aladdin. I'm eager, again, for a popular culture that reflects the diversity as well as the decency of the truly wonderful people who live in this great country. I look forward to your questions.